Don't you know? Talking about a revolution sounds
It's Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, here with co-host Bill Westmiller. Today is Thursday, February 28th, 2013, and here are some of the headlines we will be looking at today. There's a gold deal that supposedly was on the table with Iran, and Bill's going to report on that. He also is going to take a look at the Social Security deficit, while I take a look at what Ben Bernanke had to say to the House panel investigating the Fed's continued QE. Bill's got information about sequester math, and we're going to take a look back a couple years ago to when Bernard von Nothaus was convicted of counterfeiting under one of the most peculiar cases ever conducted in the United States. We're going to have a report on how gun control actually doesn't work sometimes and how sometimes guns actually are useful. And we may even get a caller today. In fact, if you've ever wanted to call in, we normally don't bring in the line, but we'll bring it in this time today to see if anybody wants to call in. The number is 888-874-4888. And if you do call in, we'll be happy to talk about stuff related to the news items of the day. But we're going to start off with a news item coming out of Europe. And people who hate bankers will love this one, but as you'll see when we go into a little bit more detail about it, it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. This is from Business Week, but actually it's been in articles all over the web. The article is, let's see, where does it say? European plans to levy the world's toughest bonus restrictions on bankers drew condemnation in London as the industry warned it may backfire as firms raise fixed pay instead. The agreement of European Parliament lawmakers and government officials in Brussels today to ban bonuses that are more than twice bankers' fixed pay starting January 1st, if ratified by European Union countries and the full Parliament, will be a blow to banks in the 27 member states, paid consultants, and the U.S. government said, or the U.K. government said. And a quote from John Terry, compensation partner at PricewaterhouseCoopers, salaries are almost certain to rise substantially, leaving banks with less flexibility to reduce or claw back bonuses when needed. The failure to grant an exclusion for employees outside the EU is a blow for the large EU banks, who will now need to compete with one-armed banks behind their banks, behind their backs, against non-EU banks in New York or Hong Kong, unquote. And actually, in the scheme of things, this really doesn't amount to a whole lot, although certainly the people who are the top players at the major banks in Europe don't like it too much. But the thing that struck me about the whole thing, Bill, is that it basically hints and broadly suggests something that has been bandied about in news and opinion circles since the 2008 crisis began, which is that there would have been no 2008 crisis if bankers hadn't simply been greedy. Which strikes me as being really kind of crazy, because the 2008 crisis didn't happen merely because bankers were greedy. It happened because the monetary system was greedy.
Or politicians were greedy. I mean, what the politicians have suddenly realized is that bankers are government employees now, and they're making more money than the politicians, which is
fair.
They can't have that. You've got to have, have to set their salary at a reasonable price. But I think probably that they're going in the wrong direction, or they're going in the right direction, because somebody who is a CEO of a bank has so many opportunities to make money, they should be paying to work in that job.
I love that logic. That's great.
Well, it's not exactly libertarian, but
it also doesn't really make any sense, but it's very funny. But the thing that really gets me about the whole story is how the idea behind it is that there's nothing wrong with the monetary system. All that happened was the bankers got extra greedy. They made loans they should never have made. And if not for that fact, everything would have been fine.
Yeah.
And that's simply not true.
Why
because
isn't that true?
The way the monetary system is designed to work. The monetary system is designed to have money continually loaned out. And when there aren't enough people to lend it out to, you lend it out to people who are less creditworthy. That's the way it's always happened. That's why there's always been financial crises in the past. And that's why there will be crises in the future as long as we have a fiat monetary system.
Well, I don't know that it's entirely fiat monetary, because the fact is that for at least two decades, U.S. law, I don't know British law from the back of my hand, U.S. law has required banks to comply with their requirements, the political requirements, for issuing mortgages. I mean, basically, the Barney Frank and a lot of other politicians in D.C. said, hey, wouldn't it be great if people could have houses even though they couldn't afford them? Let's force the banks to give loans to people without documentation. Let's give the Fannie and Freddie a couple of trillion dollars of leeway here so they can buy up all these bad mortgages and send them out into the security domain. And, you know, whether they make money or not doesn't matter. They'll probably go broke, but we'll just bail them out. So it's fine. You know, we're giving people houses for free.
Well, there's no doubt that that happened, although I think maybe there's a little bit of a tint to the way you presented that, because you make it sound like the banks did it unwillingly, like they had their hands tied behind the back. No, 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 we're not going to give these loans out. And that was not the case.
It's half and half. I mean, it's half, you know, okay, government, you're going to require us to do something. We're going to send some guys over there to tell you how to write the laws. Because we need to make money, you know, and so, well, okay, sure, yeah, you write the law that restricts your salaries. It just means that you, you know, have to do it as capital gains, which is lower tax. Oh, yeah, that's okay. That's good.
and of course, the banks also helped to write the Barney Frank laws, too, let's be honest.
Of course, of course. Yeah, that's the way it works. He who has the money gets political power.
That is true. That is true.
Of course, the problem is if the political power exists in the first place, they shouldn't have
any over those kind of Yeah, that's also
that's
true.
That's
we can try to be too pressed about that, but you're right.
Yeah.
Absolutely true. Before we get on to the next story, which is the Iran gold deal, a few weeks ago, we did a rather extensive show about alternatives to the monetary system, and particularly what would happen if the states got involved. And we actually had somebody who responded to us by email about that, and apparently he's taken us up on our invitation to call in because he's now on the line, so let's bring him on. Tom, are you there to talk with
us? Yes, I am. How are you guys?
And why don't you share with our good folks what the gist of your message was rather than having me try to tell them for you?
Well, you know, it's I really like the conversation that's going on right now, but when it comes to the states, I had read in many places, I think I emailed you two instances of it, where the state or specific counties or towns or cities had made up their own script, sort of like a corporation, like a supermarket, makes up coupons for people to come in. And this way, that script is only good within that county, and they can only be spent there. So this way, all the extra money they make adds to the money supply for that county and that county alone. And they had made deals where anybody that's got that money, you know, it could be used towards any county debt, including real estate taxes or any other type of tax or even court fines and fees. And they even made it where the money made a deal with the banks that they can actually take this script from the city and cash it into FRNs, you know, Federal Reserve notes. And so this way it would be great all over. And I remember the replies that you sent me, and none of them that I could disagree with, but I guess so long as the federal government doesn't sue the city or the state, the state has a free pass to use script.
I don't think they're
forced to enforce their own rules if they don't want to. It's quite like the immigration law. And I guess, I don't know, because I don't know of any other reason why all the information that you sent me where the states doesn't have the leeway and the power to make up their own script, but they do, and they have.
Well,
but
the
usually it's been only for a limited period of time. And that's...
The key here is not what happens at the state level. The key is what happens at the county level.
Right.
Actually, what you wrote me about was regarding states being involved, but now you're talking about counties being involved. Counties could actually issue their own script. That's not an issue. The only issue comes along when the states try to do it.
I think they try to do it, right? But the particular counties can do it. The only other thing that I spoke about on the state level is when the state tries to accept anything else other than gold and silver for debt. And I'll tell you something that had happened to someone that I know specifically. The guy was incarcerated in jail for minor petty fine, whatever. And in any case, he had some silver coins on him. and they take everything that you have on you, and then later on, they will, you know, supposed to give it back all your property. Well, he had some cash, and he had some silver coins, and what happened was the cash, they gave it to him in a check, because they deposit in a bank account, they give you a check. They don't give you cash back, at least not over here. And, you know, silver coins, Eagle silver coins, they have a dollar face value on it. So they took all their silver coins and they gave them a dollar for each one. And we know, you know, you got to pay $40 or so to get them nowadays. And they're like, well, this is a dollar face value.
What state? What state was this in?
This is New York.
In New York, okay.
Yeah, this is New York. So what the guy did was he ended up suing him for crimes of just a few hundred dollars for his silver coins. And the court's like, well, you have no standing. He's like, yeah, that's my property. He goes, no, that was monetary value. He goes, well, show me when they're in circulation. They're not in circulation. There is no silver coins in circulation, is there? They're like, no, there isn't. He's like, all right, I want it. Either that or it's theft, and I'll get you all for theft. I'll get them individually for theft.
Yeah.
And he actually got, what do you call it? He goes, well, I can't replace it for you, but we'll give you the money value. Go buy them. They didn't know where it was. Supposedly, they all said they don't know where it is. So I was like, then I got to get them for theft. And my point is that with the IRS, people have paid their employees with silver coins or gold coins where it only has the face value. And the court said they had to accept the face value. So they only had to pay taxes on the face value of it, not the actual street value. But my point is that the county shouldn't be able to accept it because it's not in circulation. It's property, no matter what kind of value they put on it. It's not money. It's not in circulation. Unless it's in circulation, it's not money.
Yeah, it's one of those fun conundrums.
And then he had a whole list of questions. Well, what's money? What's a dollar? What's this? What are the rules? And he had all the answers ahead of time, and they couldn't do it. So that's the, you know, that's really the gist of it.
That's one of those things that the courts will typically rule in favor of the government, no matter which side the government's on. So if it's the case of the IRS cracking down on somebody because they undervalued coins that they paid to somebody, then they're going to rule in favor of the IRS. But if it's the county jailers who are taking the coins and treating it at face value, they're going to rule in favor of the jailers. I mean, that's going to be the tendency.
Isn't that something? But I tell you this, there are some instances or there are some specific areas that so far as I know, the courts will not cross the line. The majority of the time, they will honor it. Almost all the time. I haven't heard it. In fact, I don't know if I heard of any instances that it hasn't, but it doesn't mean that it hasn't happened. There were some instances where the courts won't. In fact, one of his main things was is that, you know, is this judge allowing fraud into the court knowingly? And that was it. He goes, and part of the argument was the judge was like, well, you can't make that statement. And he goes, it's theft. It's a crime. And he goes, well, you can't make that legal determination. And he goes, well, was the money taken away from me? Was it given back? Was it misappropriated? I was like, okay. You know, and that was it. And if it's okay, I would like to add some comments about the conversation that was going on before I came on.
Yeah, if we can be brief, sure.
You know, there are many pieces of puzzles to the monetary system and the reason why the boom and bust happened. And to me, it's simple once you know it, but it's not quite that simple. And what I mean by that is that ultimately the money or the value of all kind of money comes from the people individually. So it starts with us and it ends as us being responsible. And I think ultimately, individually or as a group, we're all responsible. And I don't know how many people are actually aware of this. The Federal Reserve has actually holds businesses and individual people as banks. If you ever read their policy, they actually have people as banks, and they can rule businesses and make rules on individual businesses, small businesses like gas stations. So it kind of shows you how trickle down their power actually goes. But in any case, I could tell you a few things really, really quick. There is a solution to the banking system. It's very, very simple. And if I could, I'd like to just talk about that for a minute. I always been trying to get that word out, because when the whole thing comes crashing in, I'm thinking a few people have to actually know about this so that maybe a solution can be put into place. It's very practical, but let me get right to it. And I kind of like it. You take the same exact Federal Reserve that you have right now, and you find out why and what is it about it that doesn't work well. What's bad about it? And the only thing that's really bad about it, the one major thing that stands out, is that it's privately owned. So that means all the profits go to the Federal Reserve. And I know they said they'd give it to the Treasury, but that's not completely accurate. Most of it they keep, and that's trillions a year. And it's private, so they don't create the value. All a bank does, and there's only one bank, the Federal Reserve, is that they just do the accounting. That's it, supposedly. So in my case, you know, it's the individual people in the United States and the world, because it's a monetary value, that actually accept the dollar, that give it value. If nobody accepted the dollar, you know it wouldn't have no value. So we're the ones that give it the value. And I'm thinking that... And by the way, this is not my idea. I love it like it is my idea, but it's not my idea. And I'll tell you who it is. But in any case, and the whole point is, why not keep the same back that you have, the same way that it's run, everything keep it the same. The only thing that you need to change, okay, is who owns the bank. And I'm thinking, if everybody in the United States owned the bank, but it would be run by the 50 individual states in the union, not the federal government, you keep the federal government completely out, but the 50 individual states, then every single time somebody takes out a loan, and everybody who takes out a loan expects to pay interest, that interest will go to fund all levels of government, local, state, and federal. The federal government doesn't get to say how much money it gets. All 50 states decide how much it gets and how much it needs. This way, there is no more taxes. That means that it's voluntary. That means you don't have a police state anymore. That means that there's some level of freedom again. And there's privacy again. And it would fund, and you don't have to, you know, raise the interest rates up and down. You could just make, in fact, there was a study done that if it was 6% or 8% flat interest, there would be somewhere between 4 to 6 times the tax revenue they get right now, and without any of the expenses of collecting it.
Okay. Well, thanks for sharing that. Let me try to address a little bit of it. First of all, one point that really makes, I think, a big difference here that you're kind of overlooking is the idea that a money supply, in order to be a reliable money supply, must be level and steady. The kind of system you're describing really doesn't address that at all. It simply seems to continue the idea of allowing the money supply to be elastic based on everybody being their own little banking operations. And that's not going to work. All that's going to do is create tons of inflation, a lot of debasement of the currency, and ultimately that leads to the kinds of financial crises we're trying to avoid. So as intriguing perhaps as it is the idea that you've been proposing there, I don't see how it works, because it doesn't address the primary problem. And then the secondary problem it doesn't address is what goes along with the primary problem, which is fractional reserve banking. I mean, if you have major banks that engage in fractional reserve banking, then you have everybody else engaging in fractional reserve banking, and they become fractional reserve banking operations themselves. The amount of monetary inflation that potentially goes on here is staggering. It's virtually unlimited. You think QE3 is bad? Try doing QE unlimited. So those are the two problems I see. Bill, do you see anything that you'd like to comment on?
I love the idea. I'm going to open up the Federal Reserve Bank of Westmiller next week. I'm going to start printing my own money. No, Tom makes a lot of good points. And the central point is that money is what people are willing to accept. And that's always true. As long as people accept the Federal Reserve note as being valuable, then that's what it will be. As far as the other point regarding the script and you know, states and counties issuing script, that only is a problem when it comes to federal court. For example, if somebody goes to declare bankruptcy or something like that, it goes to a federal court, and they're going to say, oh, you had silver coins here that were denominated as $1, but they're actually worth $629. That's as long as the scrip or the coin is denominated in Federal Reserve notes in dollars, then there's no problem. If somebody is paid in gold coins that are stamped $1, it doesn't mean that the IRS is going to tax them as $1. They won't do that. When it goes to court, they're going to say, hey, you know, this person was paid $1,627, not $1, and we want to tax the $1,627 because that is the currency, the sole currency that is authorized in the United States of America. And the court will say, yep, you're right, bang, tax imposed. Yeah. So there's a lot of different aspects of this. The scrip is as long as it's denominated in dollars and as long as it's not competing against actual money, states could do a lot of things. For example, Utah, when they set up their gold coin thing, they really didn't do anything in terms of coining money. What they did was they said you can buy and sell gold coins without sales tax. Now, that's something that's under the state power, is the sales tax, at least for the time being. Mm-hmm. And so they can arbitrarily say, well, fine, the transaction for, you know, a gold coin doesn't have sales tax because you're supposedly exchanging currency. Well, it isn't that it's currency. It's the fact that they're willing to forego the sales tax. That's all it is.
Yeah, it would be a different question entirely if they were actually issuing currency. That's where they would run into problems. But you're right, just on the idea of a sales tax, that's totally within their purview.
Yep.
Well, Tom, thank you so much for calling in. We appreciate that. And let's get back to the headlines. Bill, you were looking into this Iran gold deal, and give us the details on what you found out.
Well, I don't know if you got the memo or not, but we've been at war with Iran for about 15 years now. But it's a different kind of war. It's a different kind of war. What it's been is an economic war. We've essentially cut off Iran, every bank in Iran, from the International Monetary Fund so that they cannot exchange their currency for other nations' currency, which means they can't buy anything. And that's a form of economic warfare, which basically makes all of their currency valueless in terms of international exchange, which is why they've had to inflate the currency and, you know, do what they've done. The other form of war is cyber war. Basically, they are committing sabotage with things like Stuxnet, destroying not just, you know, nuclear refinement facilities, but all industrial facilities that would use the Siemens controllers. There were literally hundreds of businesses in Iran that had nothing to do with a nuclear, you know, refinement process that were totally destroyed by the U.S. government in cooperation with Israel because they put out a literal bug that destroyed all the Siemens controllers. So we're basically conducting a nice, quiet, you know, no dead bodies visible war economically and cyber warfare-wise against Iran. Now, there's still a ruckus going on, and what happened was there was a meeting of what's called the P5 plus 1 group in Kazakhstan to talk about the situation with Tehran's uranium fuel. And what the world power has said was, well, you know, we've cut off all your currency, but we'll allow you to buy stuff with gold and silver and things like that in the international market. That's our deal. We'll let you do that if you stop refining uranium. And the line that they set was you can't do anything above 3% enrichment. Now, there are a lot of applications that use 20% enrichment everywhere in the world for medical purposes, for scanners, for various X-ray machines and things like that. Well, they can't make that. They can't do that under this proposal. Of course, a nuclear bomb, it has to be like 95% pure uranium. there's no evidence and there's no facts establishing the intent for Iran to be enriching uranium to that degree. The International Atomic Energy Commission inspects every single ounce. They know exactly how many grams of uranium Iran has and what the purity is. Every day they know, and they report that. And there's actually reports you can get online to find out how much of the various purities Iran has. None of it is anywhere near gold. There is no equipment, no intent, no evidence that Iran has any intention, and of course, it's said 100 times, we don't want nuclear weapons. We don't want to refine it above 20% because that's a violation of the Quran. People don't believe them, and people like to be afraid and have a boogeyman in the world who's going to blow up Israel or whatever else. So it's a little game they're playing, but it's a serious game because they're actually committing acts of war against Iran and saying, we'll let you trade in gold, but we're not going to let you use your currency in international commerce. That's a form of war. That's a form of embargo that would be considered an act of war by any other nation in any other terms.
And
so the bottom line is they're trying to play little games with Iran, and one of the games they're playing is we'll let you trade in gold.
What's really particularly peculiar about the whole thing is that all along the CIA have acknowledged that they're not creating nukes. It's been the standard line from the intelligence agencies that no nukes are being created in Iran. And yet, the Republican Party as a whole, conservatives as a large group, the Jewish lobby, this whole panoply of people are absolutely convinced that they're creating nukes. It's the craziest darn thing.
I remember seeing it a long time.
Yet it's been going on for years now.
Yeah, it isn't just CIA, though. It's Mossad that has issued public statements saying we have no evidence that Iran is doing it. And British intelligence and Russian intelligence and every other intelligence agency in the world knows damn well that Iran is not trying to produce a bomb. And they've said so publicly. But the politicians just ignore them. You know, it's a terrible, disastrous thing. And, I'm not by any means defending Iran, but under they are a signer to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. There is no evidence whatever that they've ever violated any provisions of that treaty, whereas a state like Israel has been violating it for 40 years.
Yeah.
They've never signed it, so they violated it with impunity.
Yep, that's true.
Iran is a theocracy, and they're bad people, and they're crazy and all this other kind of stuff, but they're sane actors, and a lot of people have made that point. These are not stupid people. They know exactly what's going on, and they realize the consequences of building a bomb are going to be disastrous for them.
And now apparently the craziness of politicians is no longer limited to Washington and London and Tel Aviv. Apparently now it has extended to New York, where the United Nations is, because apparently now the United Nations chief is basically saying the same thing. So this central organization, this world organization that was supposed to keep the peace, is actually the one that's waging the war. I mean, that's the darndest thing I've heard.
Yeah. Crazy.
Absolutely crazy. The other thing that's really, really bizarre about this whole ongoing stupid saga, and I guess it's not terribly surprising, but it's bizarre, is that the media, they know different. They know perfectly well what's actually going on, but it's not the way they report it. Almost to a newspaper, to a magazine, to a TV show, they all report it as if Tehran is about to arm itself with nukes and start spraying Israel and, if possible, the United States with nuclear weapons.
Well, I did a little research.
That's just the most mind-boggling part of all.
Yeah, I did a little research on Iran or Israeli politicians claiming that an attack on Israel was imminent. Of course, imminent means it's on the verge of happening within a reasonable period of time, and maybe a week or a month or even a year. Well, they've been saying exactly the same thing for 10 years.
Yep.
And no evidence whatsoever, no basis in fact. There is no imminent attack on Israel. There never has been. And it's all just a fabrication for political purposes, to scare the population so they vote in the politicians to defend them.
And it works. It works.
It does.
I mean, I've had discussions in websites, Facebook, all over the place with people
who... it works.
If you even mention this idea, if you even suggest this idea, they call you a traitor.
Yeah. Well, and the media goes hand in hand with this for their own interests. I mean, you know, why even bother to spend time talking about Iran unless you can cast them as a real boogeyman who's a threat to the entire world and is going to, you know, destroy civilization as we know it? I mean, that's why people watch. How are you going to get people to watch the commercials if you don't have a really, you know, terrible devil demon that's out there in the world trying to create havoc? I mean, so that works in the media's favor. I mean, they want drama, they want contests, they want conflicts, they want threats, because that's why people watch commercials.
Well, there's a lot of truth to that, unfortunately. Well, we're halfway through the show. Let's take a break. And then after the break, we're going to take a look at what our good friend Ben Bernanke has to say about why QE3 is so necessary. And plus, Bill's got a very interesting report on Social Security and how that trust fund may be a little bit rockier than we believed. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network. And we will be right back. We're back here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, Walton Bill on this Thursday. And Ben Bernanke made another appearance before the House, basically telling them all is well, no need to panic. And the Republicans tried to show that they are very strong, fierce, pro-hard money types, although they really aren't. And they decide to heavily criticize Mr. Bernanke. There was one particular criticism by Representative John Campbell of California. He said that the Fed's policies were mainly helping the federal government with its borrowing needs and the needs of big banks and foreign governments. And Mr. Bernanke replied that this is very much focused at the average American citizen. Because of these low rates, people are able to buy houses at very low mortgage rates, refinancing at low mortgage rates. People are able to get car loans at low rates. I thought that was particularly interesting considering how many people have had trouble getting loans lately. But nevertheless, that was his claim. The other funny/sick comment came from Representative Gary Miller, Republican of California. He said, "We have gone too far in monetary policy and the monetary easing, and it is, in this member's opinion, time to pull back." I have a question for Representative Miller. How do you know it's gone too far? How many trillions of dollars of money have to be created out of thin air before it's too far? Any ideas on that one, Bill?
Yeah, there is no limit, of course. As long as they have the total discretion as to what is a smart thing to do, they can do anything they want. And basically that's what Congress has given the Fed. Hey, you control the currency, you want to push a button and create $1 trillion, that's fine. No problem. That works just fine. What I found amusing in the Bernanke testimony was basically he granted that their quantitative easing, which is basically printing money, does entail a risk of spiraling inflation. It also destabilizes the financial system and distorts monetary decisions. He said that that's true. Yeah, sure, those are risks. But even worse than that is the risk of doing nothing at all.
Now, okay.
Exactly. Now here's what he thinks. He thinks when he pushes a button and creates $1 trillion, that is going to add more value to the economy, is going to result in bigger businesses and more financial activity, and is going to be beneficial. I mean, if he didn't think that, he wouldn't push that button. But what he's actually doing is he's devaluing everybody else's currency. Every time he pushes a button, the amount of currency in circulation increases, the value of every piece of currency in the market diminishes. Now, he can get away with this because the Labor Department and the government, you know, likes this system and believes in Keynesian economics, and so the Labor Department calculates a consumer price index, and they do it in such a way that it appears there isn't any inflation. Of course, they pretty much ignore food, they ignore gas, they ignore the standard things that people ordinarily buy, and they do this broad range of hundreds of different products to develop a consumer price index that has no correlation to inflation.
Well, of course. Like, iPads are much more important than food and water. Don't you realize that?
Well, and you know, they shuffle this, the CPI index units. They change every day. For example, a television set that now costs $1,000 tomorrow could be on sale for $800. So they adjust the CPI to say that this, you know, television set in this particular category of this particular type is now lower priced. Therefore, it's a lower consumer price. Therefore, it's lower inflation. They have no cognizance whatsoever about business efficiency, new technology. It's totally irrelevant to the CPI. So the price of standard fixed things like food, broccoli or whatever, becomes a minimal thing because that's a real standard thing that most people buy. They buy food, they buy energy, whatever it is, and they diminish that by adding all these hundreds of other things that benefit from simple efficiencies and new technology and new inventions. So Bernanke can point to the CPI and he can say, well, you know, it's only 2%, 2.5%. And I've got this is what he actually said, I have the best record on inflation of any Federal Reserve chairman in the post-war period.
Yeah.
And if you take the government statistics, that's actually almost true.
Almost.
I mean, it's 2.5%, and it's been worse in terms of the CPI. But in terms of the amount of fake money he's creating and the amount that he's depreciating the value of everybody's dollars in their billfolds is enormous in comparison with any previous Fed chairman. I mean, there's no Fed chairman that ever imagined that the Fed would be buying U.S. treasuries, all of them, because nobody else wanted to buy them, just to keep the price down. Nobody imagined that the Fed was going to be buying securities in a bankrupt company like Fannie and Freddie Mae. Nobody imagined they could do that. They've just done that, and Congress hasn't objected. So they're getting away with all kinds of financial manipulation just because the politicians actually believe that they're doing something good. They're creating wealth by pushing buttons on a computer.
Isn't that amazing? And, of course, the other thing that really helps is when you actually change the way the CPI is measured, because if we use the CPI from, like, 30 years ago, he's actually one of the worst Fed chairmen of all time. But with today's CPI, which basically flattens it out so that anything goes, yeah, he's the best.
Yeah, he's a great guy. He's wonderful.
Well, one of the factors that doesn't fall under the Bernanke purview, because, of course, he's not actually doing any price inflation, because the government says so, is Social Security. And Social Security, of course, is not being affected by this non-existent inflation, and therefore there are no problems there. Or are there? Bill, are there some problems going on with Social Security that we didn't really know about?
Oh, does anybody know for sure? Let's just take the politician's word for it. Social Security is fine. It's got no problems.
They always tell it to
But the trust fund occasionally puts out a little annual report, and they determine what their cash deficits might be like over the next 5-10 years. And surprise, surprise, every year the deadline for running out of money in the Social Security trust fund gets smaller and smaller and smaller. Well, it used to be that the Social Security Trust Fund said, well, we've got enough, you know, Federal Reserve notes and Treasury securities to cover us through 2057. And that was the number. And then a year later, they said, well, we haven't got quite enough to cover us through 2043. Well, now it's down to 2022. When they run out of money, they are totally bankrupt as of 2022, if and only if the Congress and the Fed will pay them the money that they've invested in Treasury securities.
Mm-hmm.
This assumes that there's literally trillions of dollars in their, you know, file cabinets called Treasury securities that they can sell and turn into money to give to people in the Social Security system. of course, if they were to do that over the next 10 years or 12 years or whatever number of years it is, the amount of disruption that they would cause in the financial markets would be enormous.
Mm.
Now, let's assume they did that. What is the standard Social Security law when they run out? In other words, when they've got less money coming in than is going out, and they've got all of their Treasury notes are gone, what does the law require them to do? It requires them to cut the benefits by 25%. Now, that is Social Security as we know it. A 25% cut as soon as they get rid of all of their Treasury bonds and pay out what the Congress has required them to pay out. In other words, the Social Security fund is no guarantee at all. There is no guarantee that tomorrow the Social Security Administration legally has to pay anybody anything. People think of this as an insurance program. They think the money's there. They have no doubt that they're going to be getting it until they die. It's not true. Legally, they don't have to pay anyone a cent. And financially, they've been bankrupt for 10 years because the amount of money coming in hasn't equaled what the amount of money going out. And so they've had to cash in these, you know, Treasury bonds, which is fine because, hell, the Fed's going to buy them. So, you know, Ponzi scheme was an amateur operation in comparison to what Social Security does. So anyway, the bottom line is that the number is getting closer and closer, and people are getting spooked because if the money runs out to the Social Security, then the Congress is going to be in deep doo-doo.
By the way, the article you were citing there was from Reason Magazine, and the end of the article had a very interesting little paragraph. It said that the Congressional Budget Office's latest figures are here. They have a link to it. And it says, you'll notice that the numbers show the Disability Insurance Trust Fund running out in 2016, though the document assumes that benefits will continue to be paid in full. And that's because the law requires the CBO to make that assumption.
Exactly, exactly.
Oh, my goodness.
It doesn't cost anything if you write the law saying it doesn't cost anything. You know, it's free. That's the power of politics.
But we should always trust CBO numbers, right?
Yeah, of course.
Oh, my goodness.
They know. They're the experts.
Well, the craziness is also current in that the news are all over this thing about the sequester and how the sequester is going to destroy us all. And it's the end of civilization as we know it. Certainly President Obama has been telling us that. And the Republicans have been echoing their own course on it, although their course is different from the Obama course, but basically amounts to the same thing. Sequester is evil. It's going to destroy America. You've been doing a little of the sequester math, however, and does the math add up the way that they've been reporting it to us?
It's a cut of 1% in the anticipated growth of federal spending. And we discussed this before, but I mean, here's the bottom line. It's $44 billion this year. The current federal budget is $3.5 trillion. So what we're talking about is essentially a tiny bit over 1% of what their spending has been. And fortunately, there's a lot of media, it's just Reason Magazine, but even the major media, who are recognizing that this whole sequester, you know, screaming and yelling and we're going to starve and it's going to destroy the economy and jobs are going to disappear is nonsense. It just isn't consequential. I mean, the deficit is $1.2 trillion, not the amount of spending, but just the deficit alone is $1.2 trillion. You're cutting $44 billion out of $1.2 trillion this year. You know, if the federal government
in a sense,
can't
cut out. In a sense, they're right. I mean, it is the end of the world as we know it, just not for the reason they're giving.
Well, here's the perspective, and this is what, you know, Obama is saying every other day. You know, if you cut the amount of the federal government spending, people are going to lose their jobs. I mean, there are government employees that are going to get pay cuts. There are some you know, government employees that are going to lose their jobs and be laid off, and it's going to be a total disaster. Of course, what he probably doesn't even understand is that for every one of those government employees that is laid off because the federal government is not spending the money, that is money that's left in the economy to hire people that actually do productive work. So there was an old thing that Hayek did, the seen and the unseen. So you can say, okay, if you cut the budget by $1 billion for this particular agency, then people are going to lose their jobs. Yeah, that's true. What you don't see is that $1 billion could be still retained in the economy. It's not going to just disappear because those people aren't paid. It's going to go back into the economy to the benefit of everybody across the nation. Now, you can't find the people that are going to get new jobs and get paid a portion of that $1 billion and say, you know, if you're cutting spending, you are benefiting these 100,000 people because you can't identify them. It's a general, economic distribution. But you can see the government employees that are no longer working. So it's an economic problem in that the people can't see what the consequences are of government taking money out of the economy in order to pay government employees or government projects or for giveaways or subsidies or bailouts or whatever it is. They see one side of the equation, which is supposed benefits, but they almost never see, and the politicians don't want them to see, the consequences to the general economy.
And to take these so-called cuts into a perspective that's easier perhaps for most people to understand, I find it's useful to compare the current budget proposals to the proposals or the actual budget that was in place in 2008 when the financial crisis hit, because that's kind of like a marker in history, so it's a nice useful place to point to. And it's just 5 years ago. 5 years ago, the budget was about a little over $1 trillion less than what it is currently. So these so-called budget cuts amount to being about 1% of the increase over the last 5 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's an amusing little side note. The White House Office of Management and Budget is the one that basically decides how they're going to implement the law to do the sequester. Well, among their various line items, they said, this is going to be an absolute disaster because we have to cut a full $2 million from the $20 million budget for the National Drug Intelligence Center.
Oh, I saw that.
Now, that really sounds terrible. Those poor druggies, druggie enforcement guys are just, shaking in their boots. The only problem is the National Drug Intelligence Center was closed last year. It doesn't exist.
So the question is, why do they have a budget at all?
Exactly. we're going to cut $50 billion out of defense or whatever the number really is. We're taking it out of the cost of the Afghan war, which we're trailing down anyway. Like saying, we're not going to spend $50 billion in Iraq. We're only going to spend $2 billion in Iraq. So that's a cut. Wait a second. We pulled out all the Marines and all the Army and the Navy and the Air Force. They aren't fighting in Iraq anymore. You can't spend that money on that. So that's not a cut in spending. It's just a consequence of a policy that makes sense on its own. But that's considered a cut.
Now, a listener listening to all this insanity might be asking themselves, well, if it's really true that there's really not much of a cut going on at all, that the only cut is nothing more than a little dent in a massive increase that has already taken place over the last 5 years, if it's all just a bunch of smoke and mirrors and a bunch of screaming and yelling to no purpose by people on both sides, what's the real motivation? I mean, why are they all doing this? And of course, the trite answer is, well, government and politicians always like to have as much money to spend as they humanly can. But there's another element to it, and it's an element we should not forget. That element is, it fits in perfectly with the theory of Keynesian economics to continue to spend not only this much money, but even more money by the government. Because according to Keynesian theory, that's how you stimulate an economy. You get the government to massively increase its spending, and the fallout from that will lead to an economic recovery. And there's only one problem with that theory. It doesn't work. Which I guess is, you know, kind of an important problem when you think about it. Everybody involved, the bankers, Ben Bernanke, the top people, and Ben Bernanke, by the way, comes from Princeton. He's one of the Ivy Leaguers. So it's the Ivy Leaguers. They all buy into this. The financial people buy into it. The politicians buy into it. The media buy into it. They all buy into this theory that the Keynesians have been propounding for decades, which is if you have a government that continuously spends more and more money during downtimes, you will come out of recession. You will have economic good times again, and it's simply not true.
Well, I'm glad you explained that to me.
Well, I'm not explaining it to you, actually.
Well, here's an amusing perspective on this. What is the worst possible scenario for the people who are opposed to the sequester?
Now, there's a tough question. What's the worst possible scenario?
Nobody notices. Nobody notices.
That would be bad.
The bad news is the world doesn't end on March 2nd. The worst case scenario is that the sequester hits and nobody cares. The worst possible effect is the Republicans say, well, yeah, see, it wasn't so bad. We survived that. Democrats can't stand that possibility.
Anyway. Somehow I have a feeling they'll find some way to say, well, it was really much worse than everybody ever thought it was, but we survived it somehow anyway.
Because we were so wise in deciding where to cut. You know, let's give Obama
and
discretion.
That's
so
what you were saying earlier, because politicians are all wise. That's what you were pointing out, right?
Exactly.
So the government gets to decide how wise everybody are, including themselves. That means they get to set the standard for wisdom.
Well, the whole premise of authoritarianism is that the average Joe Blow is so stupid he can't run his own life, so the government has to do it.
Unfortunately,
because the government gets to hire the experts. They know, they understand all these things. They realize exactly what's going on, and they can make it all better.
Of course, those of us who propose these ideas are considered by the people in government to be heretics and probably traitors and everything else.
No, we're just fools. Just fools. Not heretics.
Well, there's that
just
too.
Fools.
But
we just don't understand
too.
What's going on. We just don't appreciate all of the economic, you know.
I mean, criminals in some cases, because a few years ago they imprisoned a guy named Bernard von Nothaus, who actually had the audacity to say, you know, we need to have a level steady money supply, and I'm going to create one. I'm going to call it the Liberty Dollar. And it evoked a rather remarkable reaction from the prosecutor who prosecuted that counterfeiting case, in which he referred to it as a unique form of domestic terrorism.
Yeah, it is. Well, I mean, you're undercutting the whole idea that the government is the sole authority that can decide what the value of the money is and create money for people to use. You can't go off and create your own money. My God, people would abandon the government money immediately because they can see that it's totally worthless. You know,
well,
in comparison,
you can create your own money. It just can't be gold or silver, and it can't be called dollars.
Yeah, right. Right. Well, and it is terrorism because it scares the hell out of the government employees. It's true. I mean, they're terrorized that people would actually realize that there is real value in gold as a currency. You know, we talk about this all the time, but maybe next show or something we might spend a little time explaining why gold has inherent value for human beings. And there are 100 different reasons, but some people don't realize why backing the currency in gold is much better than backing it in soybeans or in, you know, computer bits or Fed exchange database digits. A lot of people don't appreciate the nature of a medium of exchange having actual inherent value to human beings.
I think that's a good idea. Let's talk about that next week.
No, we have to be careful, though. We're going to get labeled terrorists. We'll have Bernie coming down on us any day now.
Well, unfortunately, we're done for this week. But, Bill, as usual, it's been a very pleasurable experience doing the show.
My pleasure.
And we'll see you all next time here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.
I'm starting to turn, talking about a revolution. It's finally the tables. I started.